Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking a bit about the American film industry, and perhaps in a way that it's not often discussed. We'll be talking about the economics of the industry. And here's sort of the question that we have for our jumping off point. Could there be any other industry that could continue to thrive, in fact, do very well, while turning out as much bad product as Hollywood? Since the 1970s, it is fact that the American film industry has actually experienced some dramatic growth in revenue. At the same time, you have to look at the economic forces that have made that possible and ask the question, in what sort of ways do economics actually determine the kind of movies that we see? Why do we get the movies that we do? And how will new technology continue to shape the end product? Well, those are some of the questions we will be talking about this morning in this part of the show. As we talk with David Waterman, he is professor in the Department of Telecommunications at Indiana University in Bloomington and is the author of the book Hollywood's Road to Riches. It is published by the Harvard University Press and is the first comprehensive look at the economics of the movie business to come along in some time. If you're interested, the book is out now and you can certainly find it in the bookstore. And here on the program, as always, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number, if you'd like to call. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is people just try to be brief, so that we can keep the program moving along. But, of course, anyone is welcome to call. Professor Waterman, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
That's fine.
We appreciate it.
Glad to be with you.
One sort of overall question. I guess it's my understanding that the big movie studios are actually pretty cagey when it comes to economic issues, to fully disclosing things like what their costs are and particularly what their profits are. They don't really like to let go of information like that. They don't want anybody on the outside to know. Is it when you're doing something like this that really involves going after those kind of numbers, is it in fact difficult to get a hold of the raw data?
Well, if you're looking on a movie-by-movie basis, it can be pretty difficult because the studios have to pay people who have participation profits or participation rights in the movie. But when it comes to aggregate data, you know, like how much money the studios made, what was the total box office, you know, how much did people spend on videos, and how much did the studios make in total. There are pretty good numbers available for those kind of things, you know, from the trade press, because everybody in the industry now wants to have real numbers to work with. And so if we're looking at, you know, trends over a long period of time and annual data and this sort of thing, we can get pretty good numbers.
Yeah. I guess the overall point, the thing that's interesting is to note, first of all, how well the major studios have rebounded from their low point of the 70s, but also how they have managed through in various ways to maintain high levels of profits, even though the box office, that is the number of people buying tickets, mm-hmm. has gone down.
Well, in this past year, it's been a very popular topic in the press. You know, box office has fallen off in the U.S. by about 6%, and even video sales have declined very slightly, even though DVD is up and some other media are up. But it really isn't as bad as it looks. Overall, you know, when you look at all of the media that Hollywood all of the media revenues that Hollywood gets. You know, movies are distributed in theaters, on video, and pay television, airlines, and everything, and also in international markets. The revenues of Hollywood actually rose. You know, all the numbers really aren't in for 2005, but it's apparent that the total take of Hollywood actually went up in 2005. So there's a lot of focus on the box office, but in terms of the real money that they're bringing in, you know, they've been doing pretty well. Now, that's the it hasn't been the stellar year for them last year, that's for sure, particularly, you know, in contrast with the two or three or four years before. But I think the main idea, you know, that I try to develop in the book, and I think what's most significant, is really the long term, you know, as you mentioned. Since the 1970s, the revenues of Hollywood have magnified, you know, many times over as they've used all of these new media coming out in very clever kinds of ways, you know, to increase the resources that they have coming in order to produce all these big blockbuster movies that we see.
Yeah. Well, that's I think that's a key point here, that in as much as people do focus on box office, and always has been a focus of Hollywood, and that while the numbers of tickets sold have been off, the fact that ticket prices have gone up, that's helped a little bit there. But you really you cannot ignore other avenues they have for making money: pay-per-view, video cassettes, DVDs, and also the international distribution of films. Now, the studios consider the percentage that comes from showing the film outside of the United States is considerably more than it was years ago. That has changed a lot.
Well, and yeah, that's true. Since the early 1980s, at least, the proportion of revenues coming from overseas has increased, and it may set a record this year because the domestic industries we talked about hasn't been so great, and theater revenues have fallen off a little bit around the world as well, but DVD is still booming around most of the world, where DVD player penetration hasn't been as high. And it's still growing very fast, so that's a big source of the money that's coming in. But it's interesting, if you look back into the 60s and 70s, though, the Hollywood studios were getting probably about as much as they are now in percentage terms, you know, from international markets. So it's not a completely new thing, even though you're right that this sort of increased globalization, as people call this, has increased significantly, you know, in the last two or three decades.
Mm-hmm. If you go back, and not all that far, into perhaps the time that some people would describe as the golden age of Hollywood, you certainly see a time when a small number of very large studios dominated the industry, and they dominated the entire process of producing, distributing, and at one point, exhibiting the films also.
Yeah.
The company did everything, and that certainly has changed. How in what ways has how studios are structured, what they do, either changed or not changed since, say, you know, the 1930s?
Well, if you go back that far, well, if you go back even to the 1960s, because in the 1930s were really when the sort of the modern structure of the studio industry really was formed. But if you go back to the 1960s, I think the main thing that's happened since then is the conglomeration of studios. You know, for example, Paramount is a part of Viacom, a much bigger organization, and almost any of the studios that you can name, you know, are now parts of pretty large conglomerates, you know, including, you know, Disney and Columbia is owned by Sony. And the very small studios, you know, who have been absorbed by the larger studios over this period of time. But I would say that the actual functions and the degree of control that studios have over the exhibition of films and the whole variety of media is just about as great as it once was. In the 60s, you know, it was really nothing but theaters plus some fairly minor revenues coming from broadcast television. I mean, they did get up to about 20 or 25% of the total in those days. But after that, the development of video and pay television and a variety of other markets, what the studios have done have formed home video divisions or pay television divisions and such, and they have they end up releasing their movies, two independently operated and owned units, like video stores. Blockbuster has been affiliated with Viacom, but the theaters no longer are, and most of the video chains are not affiliated, and the pay television networks, are not directly affiliated with the studios, even though, a number of them are owned by the large conglomerates. But I think that the sort of the degree of control is still about as great as it was in terms of, the timing and the pricing and everything that of the studios, at least if you go back to the 60s.
We have a caller here to bring in. Let's do that on our line one in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. I was wondering if within the last, 5, maybe 10 years, if there's been a real push to make stories that, really should be kind of R-rated movies, to push them into the PG and PG-13 categories, sort of water down the, the content. And second question, I don't really know how to formulate it, but what are sort of like the, driving forces on making sequels following a huge blockbuster where they are really of poor quality? Something like Jurassic Park, where Jurassic Park 2 and 3, I guess people, Jurassic Park was such a huge hit, and then they, produced such, crap afterwards.
Yeah. Okay, well, those are good questions. Regarding the ratings, the studios are definitely thinking very carefully about what rating they want to get for a movie and what goes in and out of it. And I think you're definitely correct that R-rated type movies, may end up being PG-13, and they can manipulate this basically by the amount of sex that's in the movie and the language. And so if you want a larger audience, they generally go for PG-13. The very large audience movies are mostly PG-13.
Right.
You know, they do go the other way. If you have a movie that is sophisticated in its production and tone, and you want to really go for that type of an audience, you very often will put a little bit of gratuitous sex or gratuitous language in there to make it R, so that people don't tend to identify those movies with the great big blockbusters that are PG-13. So there's a lot of that manipulation that goes on. As far as your other question about sequels, it's often said that, the studios are unimaginative and they go for safe stuff and they don't want to take risks and stuff like that. I don't really quite see it like that. It's just that when you produce a movie, like The Matrix or something, or the Superman movies are probably a better example, where the first one does very well, it makes economic sense to produce additional versions of it, just like it makes sense to produce additional television programs in the same kind of series, because you can make some money from doing that. And it's an interesting thing you say about how the quality of these gets worse, because historically this has generally been true. And I think it's probably correct that the studios make the most money by not even trying to make a sequel movie that's as good as the original, so they tail off, and a lot of these, go direct to video. The Disney releases of their big animated movies, they just release a lot of sequels to DVD, and they're terrible.
That's what, yeah, my feeling was, too. I mean, they could invest, you know, $100 million into the first one and then $20 million into the second one where they know the people are going to buy the tickets, yet it's of, you know, they know it's of very low quality.
Yeah, you know, that's changed a little bit now in an interesting way because a number of the sequels, the recent sequels, have actually been more successful than the previous movies, you know, like Spider-Man, Spider-Man 2, for example, and the Harry Potter movies. And the mentality has changed a little bit because now the studios often see these what they call franchises, you know, several movies. They call them tentpoles now.
Right.
Are really ongoing series of movies. And as soon as you make a sequel that's obviously worse, you're going to kill the demand for later ones. So what they've been doing is investing more than they have in the past in the sequels to build up the demand for those and maintain the quality of the movies.
Lord of the Rings, be a good example.
Yeah, so they can do that. But eventually, you know, when it starts to run out, they'll start spinning off low-quality stuff.
Okay, thanks a lot.
All right, well, thanks for the call. Other questions, comments are certainly welcome. Our guest this morning, David Waterman, is professor in the Department of Telecommunications at Indiana University Bloomington and is author of the book Hollywood's Road to Riches. It's published by the Harvard University Press. And takes a look at the economics of the film business. Questions, again, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. One of the things that certainly is true now is that most of the media that we consume is produced by a small number of very large companies, and they're into everything, into books, newspapers, magazines, television, movies, radio, internet. Music. A very small number of companies, and that those companies then, as they have gotten very big and expected big profits, then have put increasing pressure on their various divisions to make money and to make a lot of money. Now, before the studios were doing well, except for that that big low dip in the 70s, I wonder if it is true that as we have more of these big multimedia conglomerates, have they placed even more pressure on their film producing divisions to make money and to make a lot of money? And does that then also one of those factors that determines what kind of movies are made?
Well, there's probably some influence in the type of movies that are made. I don't know if there's really more pressure to make profits than there was in the past. You know, if you have a movie studio that's independent, which they all were, or most of them, back to the 1960s, then, you know, they answer to their stockholders. And it's true now, you know, that the studios, some of them have been big cash cows for their conglomerates, and in some cases, like in Warner Brothers, or Time Warner, you know, they've played big roles in keeping the overall company profitable because their profit margins have been highest. And so the pressure is definitely coming from the CEOs of these big conglomerates for the studios to make more money to keep the overall results of this of the corporations up. You're right about that.
Well, one way that I guess you can make a lot of money is you can make a lot of money if you make a big movie, a big sort of action blockbuster movie, and that movie, it can be very expensive, but you can make money if you sell a lot of tickets. Now, there's also, of course, this undeniable relationship between the cost of production and how much you make. So actually, you can also make a fair amount of money on a movie if you manage to sell a lot of tickets, but it didn't cost you very much to make. And it seems that that kind of reality is something that studios have learned now within the last, I don't know, 10, 15 years. And that is why studios now have boutique divisions where they can produce smaller films, sometimes ones that are maybe a little bit more artful, appeal to an adult audience, where they can take advantage of the fact that maybe you can make a movie for $20 million, and you can really make money if you sell a lot of tickets. And in fact, you can do maybe as well as if you make a movie that cost you, I don't know how much a really expensive movie is nowadays, tens of millions of dollars more, and that you can still do well, provided, of course, you can sell a lot of tickets.
Well, that's right. I mean, there's a whole spectrum, all the way from the very cheap to the very expensive. In terms of actual dollars, you really generate the most profits from the most expensive movies. But in terms of the return, on the production investment, you can make very high returns on low production movies. I mean, for example, from last year, Saw 2, I think, cost something like $4 million and made $87 million at the box office. And the movie Crash, which is out in video now, cost about $7 million and earned about $50 million. So there's a lot of variation, and it really surprises everybody, including the studios, a lot of the time, when these films make money. And they, as you say, they have these boutique operations now, and they produce a lot of stuff, some of it artsy, and a lot of it loses money or makes very little. But there's always a few, that really flourish and make some big bucks, and then there's the big blockbusters, that they invest huge amounts in that get all of the public attention, or most of it, and they have to generate so much money to make a profit that they often turned into regrettable investments.
Sure. Well, what in terms of the things that in Hollywood that get people's attention, is it still true that the big money that you can make on a big movie is going to get more attention than the other issue where you could have very impressive return on investment, but perhaps the total profit is not going to be as big as one of those big time blockbuster popcorn kind of movies?
Yeah. Well, the public attention definitely does get riveted toward the big stuff. And, that's the big stars, the big special effects and all that kind of stuff, because you can write so many interesting things about that. And people are fascinated, by the roll of the dice, in these big films and how they can make or break a studio and this sort of thing. So everybody's interested in that. And when the small budget stuff, the kind of press that they get is when they're successful, everybody likes to write these stories, about how the studios should have known this and, why don't they go out and produce more of these cheap movies that make a lot of money instead of wasting their bucks on, these big homogenized blockbuster movies.
We have some other callers here. Someone next in Indiana on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello. I hope this is germane in some way, but you're the only person who's ever been on Dave's program that might even possibly give me some information.
All right.
I collect movies basically from the late 20s when sound came in right up to about 52, 53. And, of course, the DVD market's been very nice for people like me.
Yes.
And I've paid a lot of attention to it, and I've discovered there's an incredible range of price by one packaging firm versus another packaging firm, though it's the same movie, because I've, at times, anecdotally, I've seen, a lot of times the movie you come on is Motion Pictures for TV, have their thing up there. And sometimes you can get them for a dollar, and other times it costs you $19.95, or in various places in between. And I was wondering, along those lines, how those decisions are made, and sometimes I look at the DVD to see if I can find a code on it, see if it's been made by the same person, and just, like they do batteries, they just slap a, somebody, Exide on it or Shell or something like that on it, but it's all been made at the same, same factory. And I was wondering about that, and also in relationship to the copyright. My vague understanding is after two copyrights, it's all anybody can do anything they want to with the film. Is that true, and does that play anywhere into the DVD and video market? Thanks a lot.
Okay. Well, as far as the pricing goes, that's a very interesting question. The way the studios operate in sales is they sell the videos directly, one by one, in effect, to the video stores, or any retailer can buy them at the price advertised. And generally, you know, for a 1995 DVD of a new release movie, you know, they'll wholesale it at something like $12.95 or $14.95. And it's just like a toothpaste, you know, and the stores just mark them up. And so you see more consistency of prices for the relatively new movies, you know, that are sold one by one. When you get into these packages and stuff, you're talking about movies that have long been sold to the stores or retailers, and it's worth their selling those things at any price above the shipping costs, you know, if they can't get rid of them. And they put them in various packages, you know, to disguise the prices or whatever, but they can either try to appeal to perhaps people like you, you know, who may be extremely interested in some particular old movie made in the 30s and will pay a lot of money to get it in your collection, or they may discount them all the way down to a dollar, you know, because they have too many of them and they want to, you know, try to sell to a much wider audience of people who figure, well, for a buck, I might as well get it. And so you see big variations in the prices like that, because the tie between the retail or between the wholesale price is sort of faded away by then. So anyway, that'd be the best thing I could tell you about that. About the copyrights, the studios may, and this is my understanding of the law, I'm not a lawyer, but, you know, there's just an extension made in the Copyright Act. I think it's now 70 years that the maker of a copyrighted product, in this case we're talking about a movie, maintains the rights to that film. And so they can distribute it, and they can control the distribution of it. They can't control the ones that have already been released, so the DVDs that have already been sold. I mean, you can sell them on the used market or do whatever you want with them. But Disney recently was behind this whole thing because they wanted the Copyright Extension Act, which passed you know, Supreme Court scrutiny, I think it was last year, extending it, I think it may have been to 90 years from 70. They're protecting Mickey Mouse and, you know, all of the Disney characters, because if they lose that, they figure that they've lost an incredible franchise, and they have a lot of political influence, and they managed to get that done. So I think that nearly all of these movies that you're thinking about are going to be controlled by the copyrights of the studios that released them.
Okay, let's talk with another caller here. Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes. I was wondering about the secondary products. For example, novels, comic books, video games. What percentage of revenues is that, roughly?
You mean it's spin-offs of movies, or are you talking about the whole industry?
The whole industry.
I just don't happen to know how much comic books make, and I can't remember how much book publishing is. It's quite big. I'm sure it's bigger than movies.
Thank you very much.
Oh, thanks. Well, I assume
sorry,
that,
I don't know more
though,
that
I mean, when you're talking about spin-offs, that there again is another place where film producers and studios, people who own the content, have also found ways to make additional revenue.
Yeah, that's right. Now, merchandise sales account for something like about 6% of the total revenues, I think, of Hollywood, you know, and that includes, you know, toys, you know, these anything. Revenues, you know, come through deals from Burger King and that kind of stuff. And, you know, most of those are concentrated in a very few movies that are very popular, and which is a big concerted effort to build merchandise sales. But the overall money coming in from those is significant, and it does include, I don't know how they categorize it. Comic books aren't merchandise sales, I don't think, the way they categorize them. And they, you know, comic book sales like Batman and stuff like that, they're based in the movies, or books, you know, based on movie scripts that are written after the film is released. I forget what they call those things. They have a cute trade name for them. They account probably for a pretty minor proportion of what they make.
Our guests, let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus, David Waterman. He's professor in the Department of Telecommunications at Indiana University, Bloomington, author of the book Hollywood's Road to Riches, published by Harvard University Press. It looks at the economics of the film business, that is, of the American film industry, maybe a better way of saying it. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Something that we've touched on just a little bit here that I think is very interesting, and I'd like to have you talk some more about, is how the studios have come to appreciate and understand the power of a concept like variable pricing, and in how many different ways they have implemented it, and how, in fact, I think, according to some of the stuff that I've read recently, we shouldn't be surprised if we're going to see that more and more in terms of ticket prices. And I guess the analogy is, if you think about a passenger commercial jet airplane, and you think you go down the aisles and you start asking people how much they paid for their tickets, you will find out that if it's a big enough plane, you'll find out a big spread between the person who paid the most and the person who paid the least. And the airlines know that, and they know we can fill the seats because there are a certain number of people who pay X dollars, but then there we know some other people who will pay more. There are other people who will pay less. That one way or another, we could get all the seats filled by trying to figure out how much each individual person is willing to pay. And that's something now that movie studios are starting to think more and more about in a lot of different ways. And it goes back to this idea that if you have a DVD and it's the same one and you go to one place and it's $20 and you go to someplace else, it's two, maybe it's just because they know, well, there are some people who'll pay 20 and then there are some people who'll pay two. And that, you know, that's one way or another, you're going to sell the DVDs and you're going to make the money. Well, there's lots of different ways that the studios have found to make that work for them.
Well, that's right. And Dave, when you said all that, I thought maybe I should be interviewing you instead of the other way around, because that's the perfect analogy with the airlines. And let me just say a couple other things about it to
sure.
build on what you said, because I think that that is a big part of the explanation of why they've done so well in the market. Now, the key to this is segmenting markets, keeping people separate. And the way that works in the airline industry is the reason one person spends $1,200 for a ticket to New York and somebody else right next to him spends $100 or $150 is because there's an advance purchase requirement, for example, and the business traveler paying $1,200 really can't take advantage of an advance purchase with no refund and all this kind of thing, because they have to maintain the flexibility to go on short notice to a meeting. And the way the movie studios do the segmentation is really by time and quality of exhibition. So you notice the time lag between theaters and video, between video and pay TV. The ticket price is actually pretty high compared to the video price when you think of the fact that even though you spend $15 on a video, you can watch it 10 times. You pay $7 for a movie ticket and you watch it once. And, so the revenues per capita are really higher for the studio from theaters. And the way they keep those markets separate is this time lapse between theater and video. The people who really want to see the movie badly will go to the theater and pay more. And the people who want to see it somewhat will buy the video or rent the video. Those who are very interested in the video market will buy it. Those who are moderately interested will rent it, and only see it once. And those who don't care that much will wait for a pay TV exhibition, on home box office 12 months later. And when you add it all up and look at the money, the studios are making a lot from the theaters and the video, and then it tails on down to broadcast TV. And, people who want high quality of exhibition also will pay more for it. People who demand high quality tend to be relatively impatient types, turns out, and they will pay to go to a theater because it's a more dramatic and impressive experience, than watching something on a small screen at home. And as media have proliferated in the last 25 years or so, particularly, the studios have carved up the audience into finer and finer groups, and they've managed to segment them, which basically means, by the way, figuring out a way to keep the higher value consumers from taking advantage of the low prices, which is, I told you the trick in the airlines and using the time and quality in the movies. And that's really been a big factor in the way the studios have come up with so much money.
The thing that really interests me was an article that I read not very long ago suggesting that the exhibitors are starting to think more and more about how you can apply the same principle to theatergoers, and that there may already have been some experimentation with this, or maybe they think they're going to, and it sort of goes back to the old idea that if you go to a matinee, you pay less. And the idea would be that, okay, they're thinking that maybe we have some people that they want to see that movie so badly, they want to see it right away when it opens. They want to be the first people in the theater for the first showing. They figure, well, okay, those people are going to be willing to pay some money to see the movie. And then maybe there are people who are willing to wait a couple of weeks that will, they want to see the movie too, but they're not going to pay as much as the first nighters. So maybe we have a different rate for them. Or maybe we do something like we take a look at times of the day, for example. You know, maybe the prime time, maybe there are some people who really want to go at 7 o'clock, 7 p.m., and they would be willing to pay more than the people who could go at 1 o'clock in the afternoon or at midnight. You know, so maybe then you take a look at the times your theater is sort of empty and you think, well, maybe if we aggressively promote a lower ticket price, we can get some butts in the seats at times when otherwise we wouldn't. And that that really does carry on that analogy of the passenger plane, where you think about theater seats and how much people are willing to pay for a ticket.
Well, that's right. There's nothing that stimulates thinking like this, like falling revenues, you know. So they start thinking about what are ideas about how I can make more money. So it shakes up the complacency. But you're right, too. It's been going on for a very long time, this kind of thing. And it's curious, you know, that in some other countries of the world, they do price theater tickets like this. And they also divide up the house, so people sitting in the better seats in some markets pay more than the people sitting in the worst seats, just like they do at an opera performance, a rock concert, or a football game, I guess, better. And so now they're starting to think about these things. I think that the theater owners, the potential for generating real extra money from doing things like this are probably pretty marginal. I don't think there's that much more you can squeeze out of the theater patrons. And it's a question of how resistant theater patrons will be to this kind of thing. They want to be very careful. For example, if you have a movie coming out the first week of release, and if you price it, you try to get higher prices than those eager people coming, what if you overprice and then very few people show up, and then the box office results come out, and people watch these and say, well, nobody, people aren't going to that movie. You can hurt the revenue downstream. So you got to be very careful about this, because people watch these things. And, just like when you have a rock band touring around the country, you don't want to price those tickets to the amount that you think you can probably get, because the dread is you won't fill the arena, and you won't have long lines outside, you know, for the press to write about and for the, you know, to build a thrill inside the arena and stuff like that. So you have to be pretty careful about these things they're trying to do now.
Yeah. One of the things that you write about in several ways that also I think is really interesting is how it is that when new technologies come along, or perhaps new methods of distribution, something that's new, it seems that right away that people in the industry say, oh, no, this is the end. And then if they're smart, they find some way to make this work for them. And I think about this going back all the way to when television really became big, and we come to the point where just about every American home had one. And this really was responsible for a downturn in box office. I mean, that was this really dim, grim period going back to maybe about the 70s when the Hollywood was at its low point, that television really had an awful lot to do with that. And I'm sure at the time that people made this prediction that that television would kill theaters and would kill movies and kill the theater-going experience. And while there was a dip, well, we still have movies and people still go to the movies and the industry is doing pretty well. Maybe you could talk a little bit about, particularly about that period and about television and about what happened and about how it is that the studios managed to figure out how to make that work for them. It did change things, and there was a low point, but then things did get better.
Well, okay, yeah. Television came in the late 1940s, and it really had a devastating effect on theater admissions. And if you look at it in a per capita term, they literally fell to about 1/8 the level that they were in the mid and late 1940s, just after the Second World War. And that really changed the audience very substantially. So what television offered was, you know, just a whole new way to entertain yourself, you know, for free. And so people naturally took advantage of this, and new entertainment forms, you know, like the series programming and all this kind of stuff, were developed on television. And the kind of sales that the studios managed to make to broadcast television, you know, of old movies, didn't come anywhere near making up for this. I mean, you know, the theater revenues fell way down, but they could only get pennies from the television networks or the television stations because advertisers were only paid so much, you know, for somebody to sit there and watch a commercial. So there's a very firm upper limit cap on what the studios could ever get from broadcast TV. And how all that changed in the 1970s was with the development of paid media, like pay television and video, which of course is a you know, the pay by the watch basically mechanism, and you know, the later development of pay-per-view and other things like this, is when those things came out, people thought that, a lot of people, that the effect would be the same, that you know, theaters would go through another devastation, and certainly that broadcast TV would practically disappear as an exhibition medium for movies. But what actually happened is kind of what I call in the book kind of a stacking phenomenon, which is that remarkably, in this case, the theater revenues and the video revenues and the pay TV revenues and, you know, airlines and all this have basically sort of stacked on top of each other after this. And in fact, even broadcast television has remained a pretty healthy medium, relatively speaking, for the exhibition of movies. And the reason they've been able to do this is the market segmentation phenomenon. They've figured out all these ways to keep the audiences for these media separate, and they've done this also to encourage a lot of repeat viewing. And repeat viewing is done by the highest value viewers. So if you love a movie, you go watch it in the theater, and then you buy the DVD, and you watch the DVD a few times, and then you may have a pay television subscription and see it there, and then it comes out on broadcast TV, and you say, what the heck, I'll watch it. And so that's really part of the story, you know, but it was very different for broadcast TV than it was for these pay-by-the-view media.
There is this certain pattern that people have gotten used to in terms of how movies become available, when you can see them, and how much you're going to pay.
Yeah.
And that the studios know that there are certain people who want to be there the first night, and then maybe there are some people who will be willing to wait a couple of weeks, and then there are some people who will say, well, I'll wait until it comes on HBO or until I can go down to Blockbuster and rent the DVD. You know, and you know, one thing that has happened is that this sort of schedule of how things become available has started to become compressed. And in fact, recently there have been some filmmakers who, I don't know how significant it is, but who have sort of experimented with this idea that says, let's release it every way we can release it all at once.
Yeah.
Let's not do that other thing. And given that it seems that there are more people who are willing to wait Maybe part of the phenomenon of the declining box office has something to do with people saying, "Well, I wouldn't mind seeing that movie, but you know, in 6 months we can go down to Blockbuster and get it, so we can just wait." Is it likely that this kind of schedule of releasing will become even more compressed, and that more material will be available in more kinds of ways sooner?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I think that'll probably happen. Now, let me say this about that. In terms of the time lapse between theaters and video, that has shortened significantly in the last 3 years on average to about 4.5 months now, where it was about 6 months, and there was a before. And it's a pretty sudden drop a couple of years ago. And that makes economic sense to the extent that as the video market becomes economically more important relative to theaters, which has been a long-term trend, you know, because video revenues, particularly with DVD, contribute about twice as much to the studio's coffers as theater revenues do, the more profitable it is to move the video release closer. For one thing, the studios don't get paid until they get that video release. And the other is if the longer you leave the movie out of the market before video, you know, the more passé the movie comes, the more people tend to forget about the advertising campaign and all this. So it makes some economic sense to move it up to the front. But the studios collectively realize that this market segmentation system that they have is something that generates real money from them. And I think that if they were all to be a monopoly and to have a meeting about what they wanted to do with this video window, as it's called, that time release, they would vote to keep it. But in the competitive market, you can't necessarily do that. And what's been going on now is very interesting. You may have seen the publicity about the movie called Bubble. Steven Soderbergh, who's a high-profile director, and done some, you know, did Ocean's 12, and he's also done some very artsy kind of stuff. He released this movie just about 2 weeks ago, January, simultaneously on high-definition television, pay television, in theaters and on DVD. And it didn't really do very well. It made very little money, made a tiny amount of money in theaters, something like $70,000, which is pennies, you know, compared to the $100 million that some movies bring in over the first week. But you notice that those movies, and another experiment to come by, I forget the name of the movie, but the Voom television system is going to do that in 2007. They're basically publicity stunts, and they're done by independents. You know, the movie studios haven't anything to do with these. And the problem they create for the studios is people's expectations about when a movie is going to be released on video are formed by, inevitably, by the average that they observe in the market of when most movies are released on video. And the studios are worried about this, these experiments, because they muddle up people's ideas in their mind about them, but, you know, what this release date would be. So it's not clear the studios will be able to control the compression of these release dates down to a very low level, and it's possible that the video window will disappear in the next few years, both because of legitimate pressures, you know, toward higher revenues to be earned from video, and because of too many independents making these experiments in the market.
We have a couple of minutes left. We have a caller here. I want to get to cell phone caller here, line number one. Hello.
Hello. Hello. Are you? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, okay, good. I did not get to join the broadcast until almost halfway through, so you may have actually covered this. As a bit of a movie buff, I find myself waiting for DVDs to come out because I want to hear reviews from people that I whose views I respect on movies before I pay the theater prices. This I got caught with Peter Jackson's King Kong, which, you know, got all sorts of great press. But then when I went to see this, I saw that all he did was take a very, very old special effects movie and draw it out for 3 hours. It really wasn't all that great. What I'm wondering is, you know, do the studios actually pay attention to people like me in terms of, you know, trying to find out what will draw us into the theaters in terms of quality, rather than just kind of writing it off and saying, well, they'll go ahead and buy the video. I'm going to go ahead and hang up and listen on the air.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, they're interested in everybody, but in a case like Hong Kong, they're mostly interested in the mass audience. And you'll notice that that movie, you know, it, with all the special effects and the action and everything, is designed for a mass audience and has a lot of appealing characteristics to the mass audience. And that's really the way they generate revenues. And it's interesting the way you phrase this, because I think that in a way, what they try to do in spending all of this money on special effects and in, you know, the best possible production values in the movie is they buy people like you. They buy audiences who were willing to come in to see a movie even though they have a questionable feeling about what the artistic values will be, or the sophistication of the movie in terms of its of its plot and its meaningfulness and this sort of thing. But if they spend enough money on all of this stuff and turn it into a real show like this, they will hypnotize enough people into the theaters and to buy the DVDs, you know, so that they can make enough money even from people like you who are sort of on the margin and would probably prefer something a little more sophisticated.
I must jump in here and say that we're going to have to stop because we've come to the end of the time. There's a lot more in this book that we really haven't touched on. So certainly for people who are interested in the film business and in the economics of the film business, you can take a look at the book. It's titled Hollywood's Road to Riches. It's published by the Harvard University Press by our guest David Waterman. He's professor in the Department of Telecommunications at Indiana University in Bloomington. And Professor Waterman, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it.